Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast series of the CMT Association, hosted by David Lundgren and Tyler Wood. This monthly podcast will bring veteran market analysts and money managers into conversations that will explore the interviewees' investment philosophy, their process, and decision-making tools. By learning more about their key mentors, early influences, and their long careers in financial services, Fill the Gap will highlight lessons our guests have learned over many decades and multiple market cycles. Join us in conversation with the men and women of Wall Street who discovered, engineered, and refined the discipline of technical market analysis. Good afternoon, Friday, April 1st of 2022. David Lundgren, welcome to episode 16 of Fill the Gap. How are you doing,
my friend Tyler? Good to see you.
It's good to see you too, you know? Still wearing some polar fleeces, some vests up here. Springtime in upstate is a chilly affair, but very happy that today we get to have our other best friend, Bill Kelleher, CMT CFA. How are you today, Bill?
I'm doing great, Tyler. Dave, thanks for having me. It's my favorite time of the year. It's time for our annual symposium.
That's exactly what we wanted to talk about before we get to today's episode with JC Peretz, that annual get-together for market technicians, asset managers, research analysts, institutional traders. Bill, you've been the chair of the symposium for well over a decade now. Talk to us a little bit about what's going to be happening this spring.
Well, Tyler, it's a great tradition. I'm really excited to bring this event back. You know, as we're starting to normalize a little bit, it was important for us to bring back that in-person tradition where some of the best networking happens, bringing some of the best minds of technical analysis and bring everybody together to learn from each other. And next year is going to be our 50th anniversary of the CMT Association. It was important for us to bring this event back before that 50th anniversary. And so this year's event's going to be a hybrid event in Washington, D.C.
Absolutely.
So hybrid meaning live and online.
That's right, Dave. We've been virtual for the last 2 years with all of our events. And so we wanted to have that live event, but we also recognize that there's still parts of the world that can't travel.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's fantastic.
I've been talking to hundreds of members over the last few months, members and candidates and lots of folks who had questions about why aren't you going to be back in New York City? You know, the headquarters of the CMT Association being right down on Broad and Wall Street as it has been for nearly 50 years. But we're in DC this year in part because the facility for this conference is fantastic. They also have all of the capabilities of a fully serviced television studio so we can broadcast that around the world. But in talking with JC, you know, the networking component of this conference has been so important for him and his career and finding mentors. I think it can't be understated, you know, to be outside of New York City in a space where you've got a little more room to move around. For all of our networking events, we'll have some outdoor space so people can feel comfortable getting together with colleagues and clients and old friends without any fear of, you know, being confined in small spaces as we often find ourselves in New York City. So that element of Washington, D.C. in the springtime, cherry blossoms, better weather, I think this is going to be an event to remember. Bill, why don't we talk a little bit about some of the speakers that are going to be there this year in 2022?
I'm terribly excited to bring back John Bollinger. John Bollinger is going to kick off the event. The symposium is a great mix of classical technical analysis, as well as some of the emerging new trends in the market, whether it's market structure, whether it's new products like cryptocurrencies, altcoins. We look at the symposium from both a bottom-up and a top-down approach, meaning that from the bottom-up, we try to highlight different individuals that, you know, that we'd love to have present. And from the top down, we're looking at content, you know, what's trending in the markets or the market environment today in the industry today. So we're looking at building the symposium from both approaches. For me, you know, one of the things that really excites me about the symposium, like early on in my career, it was actually attending one of the symposiums that really inspired me to get more involved in the CMT Association. Very early in my career, when I was working on the Boston Stock Exchange and learning new tools and to become a better trader, I attended the event, a symposium down in Florida. And I was much younger at that point, you know, 15, 20 years ago. And
well, you said Boston Stock Exchange, so you had to be quite young.
Yeah, explain to the kids what that is. Yeah, remember those things, those exchanges when things were actually traded?
There used to be one in Boston. Yeah, I used to report from the floor. Remember that? You remember that?
That's right. Dave used to report live from the Boston Stock Exchange.
WBZ Channel 4. 5 o'clock in the morning.
Okay, so for all of the millennials who are listening, that was on a TV. It was a thing that we used to use to get information. Now it's all streamed on Netflix or you just go to Twitter. But in the old days, we used to watch TV.
And the hot technology at the time was the fact that we thought we were connected electronically. And of course, you can do all this from home now, which is amazing. But early on, recognizing to become a better trader is actually the fact that exchanges were in transition and fintech was changing the market structure quite a bit. And even then, the exchange model had changed, whereas the New York Stock Exchange, you know, was really where prices were established. But as new exchanges and new markets picked up, you know, we recognized that you had to become a better trader. And that's what actually led me to the CMT Association, and I attended their annual symposium. And just to meet more people and actually meeting John Bollinger at the time, it was one of the highlights for me at that symposium. And so it's kind of come full circle, which is kind of neat where John's going to be presenting for us this year. And he's so generous with his research and his philosophies and just the market history that his knowledge over the years and to share it publicly. And that's what really inspired me to get more involved. Actually led me to becoming more involved in our Boston chapter, and then eventually led me to chairing up these events, the symposium events.
And we've got a number of Fill the Gap guests who are going to be speaking at the conference again this year. Mr. Jim Bianco, who we had the pleasure of interviewing late December. Episode came out in January. And Bill, you know, we're talking about all asset classes. When you come to a technical analysis conference, it's not an equities only game. It's not a currencies conference. It's all across the board. And I think that today's guest for this episode really exemplifies just how you can look across all asset classes, across global indices, using the same technical tools and process to get an understanding of what's happening from an intermarket or cross asset approach. And Dave, I just wanted to ask you, you know, in terms of this interview with JC, what were some of the biggest takeaways for you from our interview?
Well, I mean, for me, I think I'd have to highlight the incredible innovation that he's bringing to the crypto space. We actually had a conversation after the recording, and we may have mentioned it in the recording as well, but developing advanced decline lines. And what was fascinating to me was just the ability to take an entirely new, truly from the ground up new asset class and just apply the very same technical tools that we've been using since the beginning of time, it seems like. And they're all just as relevant in this new asset class as they are in any asset class. And that's one of the great things about technicals is there's volumes of academic research to demonstrate the efficacy of technical analysis across timeframes, asset classes, geographies, et cetera. So I thought that was pretty incredible. And his knowledge and his engagement with that community, I think, is a real asset because he brings a lot of knowledge to the conversation. And he's very generous with his willingness to share what he's learned. And he's very humble about what he doesn't know. And from that perspective, it's just another great conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, you know, one of the things that JC highlighted during the conversation was just how much he has learned from mentors throughout the association. And I think it's hilarious to think about JC, who is a youngster like myself 10 years ago, just getting involved. And Bill, here you are talking about being a youngster on the floor of the Boston Exchange, but getting access to people that otherwise are probably bombarded throughout the week by sales traders and folks trying to get them to buy into things. But within this community, they are extremely generous with their time, with their expertise, and their willingness to coach others. And so to see the young JC, who is now so influential and such a mentor to so many young technicians all over the world, whether you're talking about New Zealand, Venezuela, or Madrid, it seems like there is a young technician working with JC on something. And Bill, you were mentioning just a moment ago about one of your favorite moments from our first year running the symposium together. Share with us a little bit about what you remember from the young JC.
Yeah, Tyler, as we were talking about JC in this month's podcast, I was sharing one of my favorite memories from an earlier symposium. And I believe it was 2014, about 8 years ago. JC was sitting with Luis Yamada, and the two of them were in a very in-depth conversation, and I happened to, you know, walk over and here's Luis, one of the, you know, most influential technical analysts over the last few decades, and JC, the, you know, young, one of his first symposiums, I believe, and here he is teaching Louise about social media and about Twitter and chatting back and forth about what the different symbols mean. And, you know, of course, there's dollar signs in front of symbols and
hashtags and hashtags.
I know. So it was to see JC teaching Louise. And it was just the beginning of another relationship that over the years where they've been able to share back and forth and Louise teaching JC about, you know, different elements of her research and year after year, seeing them both come back to the symposium and you know, having those conversations, which all started just from a simple conversation that they were having in between sessions. That's another great thing about our symposiums, you know, the caliber of attendees, like most of the people there could actually be presenting or should, you know, or have presented in the past. That's one of the great things about, you know, our event, not only the ability to network, but to share research or to share perspectives, experiences. And a lot of times, even our content, you know, I always say it's great when you get great takeaways, or for me, it's always been great attending those early in my career, the symposium, and learn a little bit more about a topic. Not just great networking, but also you get great takeaways.
And you see that living spirit of lifelong learners where Ralph and Louise and JC are always in the front row with a notepad, taking down as much as they can learn from all of our illustrious speakers and guests. Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you spending some time this afternoon. Let's introduce JC Peretz, episode 16 of Fill the Gap.
Thanks, Tyler. And thanks for joining us, Bill. It's great to see you. And thanks for everything you do for the organization.
Thanks, guys. Great being here. We'll see you in DC.
Register now for the 2022 CMT Symposium, April 28th and 29th in Washington, D.C. Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima, a professional charting and data analytics platform. Whether you are a professional analyst, portfolio manager, or trader, Optima provides advanced technical and quantitative software to help you discover financial opportunities. Candidates in the CMT program gain free access to these powerful tools during the course of their study. Learn more at optima.com.
Welcome to Fill the Gap, the official podcast of the CMT Association. We are sitting down with perhaps the industry's most well-known technical analyst, JC Peretz. JC is a CMT charter holder and founder and chief market strategist at All-Star Charts. In addition, JC is a rabid sports fan, being a former Division I athlete himself. And of all things, JC is a wine sommelier. I suspect this will be a wide-ranging conversation. JC, welcome to Fill the Gap.
Well, I appreciate that, David. Some of those are very nice words. Thank you.
Well, you live up to them, so I'm sure they weren't nice enough. As I just intro, we have so much we can talk about, and you are a prolific contributor to the conversation in social media and traditional media. You cover everything. You've even coined some new pattern names. I don't know if you caught this, Tyler, but you know, JC, you're the first person I've ever heard someone refer to the Kardashian bottom.
Yeah.
Was that yours?
No, that's Joe Fahmy.
Are you sure it wasn't Alan Shaw? I think he's paying attention to the Kardashians.
Listen, yeah. The Kardashian bottom is an important pattern because we're talking about big bases, right? Like big bottoming processes, explosive resolutions.
Yeah, I think when you said it, you were referring to the energy relative performance bottom. That's when I saw you say it.
Listen, yeah. I mean, look at energy on a relative basis, been bottoming out for a little bit. I mean, that thing's been in decline forever. From what I see, early stages maybe of a commodity super cycle. Kids these days don't know about oil and gas stocks. Like, you know, those of us who traded, and both of you are older than I am, by the way, I'll throw that one out there, traded in prior cycles. So we remember when technology and growth was an afterthought. By the way, interest rates were rising then too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right, exactly. So I can't wait to jump down this rabbit hole with you, talk about markets, everything else. But before we do that, give our listeners a little bit of insight into who JC Peretz is, a little bit of your background, what got you into the business, but more importantly, what got you to a trough we call technical analysis?
Yeah, I mean, listen, I appreciate you guys having me. This is fantastic. It's totally an honor for me. I've always looked up to technicians, you know, yourself included, David, for sure, among many others that I've learned from over the years. And the association has really been that bridge for me and for a lot of other people, by the way. So I didn't, my family wasn't really into the market, you know, mutual funds and 401ks and real estate and just entrepreneurship was really sort of where my family was. I grew up in Miami. Both my parents were born in Cuba. So I'm first generation here in the country, along with a lot of other people that I grew up with in Miami. In my high school and elementary was predominantly Cuban immigrants. So that's really who I was surrounded by until I was 18 years old. And I went to Fairfield University in Connecticut. You know, I went to a Jesuit high school. So a Jesuit university was, you know, appealing, and it was a very good school, certainly a much better school than my grades could have gotten me into. But I just happened to throw a pretty decent curveball. You know, you called me a Division I athlete. I was a pitcher. So, you know, athlete's a strong word. And although, yes, Division One, we played in the MAC conference, you know, with the likes of St. Peter's and Marist and Niagara and Canisius and Siena. You know, those are the schools in my conference. I got back to back home runs hit off me at UConn, though. So that was a big highlight for me.
We can edit that out. Don't you worry.
I also shut down FIU, who was ranked like 15th at the time. So, you know, it goes both ways, ups and
downs.
There we go. A lot of good lessons for the market, most certainly. Yeah. As an athlete, yeah, you're going to fail constantly, you know, and being able to deal with that and move on and go, you know, you strike out. All right. So what? You go back on the field, you play for a few more innings. Maybe you get another chance. Then you can hit a home run, and you probably won't. You'll probably ground into a double play, and you're going to have to get over it again. And you're just getting punched in the face so many times that you just become numb to it after a while. And it's like, whatever, this is part of the game. I understand if I bat 300 or God forbid 400, that makes me the best player in the league, you know, so that means I'm going to fail 60 to 70% of the time. And if I do that for a career, I get inducted into the Hall of Fame. So once you understand those mechanics, and it's the same thing in the market, right? You know, you're going to fail a whole bunch of times. When you're wrong, make sure you're wrong small. When you're right, make sure you nail it. Just like when you get a fat watermelon, you want to hit it 400 feet over the fence, and you want to lay off the curveballs in the dirt, right? So, you know, there's a lot of lessons that I learned playing baseball that helped me in the market. So anyway, here I am at Fairfield University, just playing baseball, you know, trying to throw good parties. I mean, like any college kid. And I interned at Merrill Lynch, and that was it for me. Love at first sight, 100%. I was all in. I was an accounting major at the time. Man, do I hate accounting. I there are things I hate more than accounting. It's like accounting, the Florida Gators, and the Jets. And the New York Jets, like those three things, like I have this passionate hatred for. So as soon as I started working at Merrill, that was it. That was it for me.
Yeah. And what was the internship?
I mean, I was getting coffee and you know, stuffing envelopes and making coffee, you know, making copies and stuff for like big PMs at Merrill, you know, big financial advisors. These guys were monsters. They were playing golf every day. It was awesome. But I started reading the journal. I started reading IBD, like, and that's really what my first glance into technical analysis was, this little like blurb that Investor's Business Daily used to have. I think it was like on the front page. And it would talk about like the advanced decline line, like market breadth, you know, certain price action. And I was like, this is way better than like this, like M&A gossip that they keep writing about on this page over here, you know, so that, and then also nothing else worked, right? Nothing else seemed to work in fundamental analysis. And that's how I got into technicals. And as soon as I opened up the John Murphy books and the Edwards and McGee books, this was like an 05. That was it for me. I was hooked.
Yeah, I could see why.
And who put the Edwards and McGee book in your hand, JC?
The MT Association.
Gotcha.
Because back in the old days, which is the way it should be, is that they would just make us read all the old books, right? Like now there's a curriculum and this whole thing, which if anybody's listening out there who's studying the curriculum, obviously do that because that's where you need to pass the test. But you still have to go read those old books also, right?
Like
that enough.
I love that this is maybe the first time JC Perrette sounds like a curmudgeonly old grandpa. You know, you just put like 30 years on your belt, bro. Go back and read Edwards and McGee.
And when you're done reading it, read it again.
Yeah,
yes, exactly.
good point.
So tell us about All-Star Charts, which is a great service, by the way.
So 2009, 2008, 2009 financial crisis, you know, I had a front row seat. I was working on 46 and Park, literally kitty corner to Bear Stearns. So like front row seat to the whole thing. It was sick. Great experience. So I don't care how old you are. You haven't seen anything I haven't seen, you know?
Yeah. Were you still at Merrill at the time?
No. I was working out. Merrill was just an internship while I was in college. Yeah. I ultimately got hired by Josh Brown, who's, you know, built the $2 billion RIA.
Yeah.
And he was my first boss out of college when I was 22 years old. So been old buddies ever since, obviously.
Yeah.
And so him and I went through that period together. And then he started his blog. So, the financial crisis was really what sparked financial social media that we know today. Not that many people trusted the banks and the media back then to begin with, but that was like the final nail in the coffin.
Yeah,
you can't trust the media. They're full of it. They have their own agenda. We obviously can't trust banks. This is all their fault, blah, blah, blah. So what happened? That was the beginning of the blogosphere. So now instead of having to go to a TV channel or a newspaper to find out what the analyst or the trader says, we could just go to the analyst or the trader's blog and hear it directly from the horse's mouth, or the Economist blog, or the VC's blog in the case of Fred Wilson. But like, you had experts in their fields all now having their own voice, where you can just go directly to the voice instead of the dinosaur, you know, newspaper and television, right? You can go, and that was the beginning. So now I'm a consumer of all of these blogs. I'm learning tremendously. And then some of my other friends are starting blogs and they're like, JC, why don't you have a blog? I was like, I don't know how to do that. So, you know, we figured it out and we got a blog, and this was in 2010. So it was, you know, at the time they told me that everybody has a blog. It's too late for blogs. This was in 2010. They were telling me it was already too late. Obviously it wasn't, you know, it was early in that game. And, you know, Twitter was getting popular as well, because that was an intraday conversation amongst the blogging community. So now not only do we have the individual blog landing pages, but now everybody's having this conversation together on Twitter. And those who are on Twitter having these conversations that didn't have blogs were like, well, I'm going to go start my blog. You know, so that's how really, you know, and financial Twitter was a happy hour in Soho in 2008 and 2009. Now it's this massive global infrastructure and conversation happening intraday. And, you know, it's been beautiful to watch it, you know, grow. So All Star Charts was my blog. It was just my way to put ideas down on paper. Hey, look at what the dollar's doing. Look at the breakout in Cisco, gold breaking down, whatever. I encourage
top 10 places to eat in New York City, you know, point your friends to the blog as opposed to answering the same question for everybody who comes through New York.
Right. So, yeah. So that's another great point, Tyler, because I would get a lot of questions. I still do. And when a question keeps coming up, I just write a blog post about it. And now every time in the future I get asked about it, here you go. Here's everything on that subject. So it was very good. And, you know, we turned it into a publishing company, right? Everybody's like, JC, give us more, give us more. I was like, all right, I'll give you more. So then we just started the publishing side of it. And I mean, it turned into what you see today. I mean, we have thousands of clients all over the world. Everybody from the biggest hedge funds and banks that you know, pretty much every major RIA, a lot of major hedge funds, market wizards. These are all clients of mine now. I get to talk to all of them and share ideas and go back and forth, and they're paying me to talk to them. Like, I should be paying them.
Yeah. And so obviously that's massive success. So what else is there left to do but to become a wine sommelier, right?
Well, all right. So rewind. So, all right. So here we are, 2022. So it's easy to say in hindsight, but like at the time when I realized, you know, the publishing side of the business could be massive, I was in New York City, a lot of networking, a lot of them dinners every night. Like, I mean, we were out a lot. Like, it was just, I was busy. All of that stuff is great and it serves its purpose, but like, I had to like build, put my head down and build. And I was like, I'm getting the hell out of here. So my girlfriend and I, my wife and mother of my daughter today, but at the time Morgan was my girlfriend, we moved out to California. We moved out to Sonoma in California, right in the heart of wine country. So I started reading some books on wine. I figured if I'm here, maybe I should probably know a thing or two about wine. So started reading the Wine for Dummies books. One thing leads to another. Now I'm a certified sommelier. I got a vineyard in Napa. I'm making Cabernet Sauvignon. So I got some things happening.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, so I have to ask this question then. So we all know the lines that can be drawn pretty easily between, say, like you just did it earlier, baseball and investing. Anything that you learned in learning about wine that translates to the markets, otherwise, other than they go together really well?
100%.
It's a great pairing.
Some audiences are technical analysts. Don't you understand? Okay, they use a deductive method. It's a top-down approach. So in the same way that we start with the trends of stocks and interest rates and commodities and look at global markets and look at stocks as an asset class and work our way down, be like, okay, Latin America's underperforming. It's more Europe that's outperforming and industrials over there. So we work our way down. So by the time we decide we're going to buy Caterpillar, there's 1,000 reasons why we're buying Caterpillar that have nothing to do with the chart of Caterpillar, right? We're doing that top-down deductive approach that a lot of technicians, I'm not going to put words in your mouth. I know you do some of those things, but for us, I'm very top-down oriented. And then I'm sitting here like in some LEA school, like going through this. I'm like, are you kidding me? You guys do the same shit as us. Like, this is, you look at the wine, and if it's a white wine, then you know it's not Cab Sauv, it's not a Pinot Noir, it's not a Sangiovese, it can't be any of those because it's a white wine. And then you look at the color of the white wine, and you can start eliminating others, and you smell it, you can eliminate more. By the time you're even tasting the wine, you've already eliminated 80% of the possibilities. The top down.
So you're going through that exercise to try to understand what the wine is without knowing what it is.
Right. So this is what's called blind tasting. So they put on the exam, they put two whites, two reds, and you got to say everything: the vintage year, the country, the grape, the acidity levels, alcohol, tannins, the whole thing. It's like next to impossible. And not only is it next to impossible, they don't tell you what the wine was. They just tell you whether you passed or failed. So I don't even know if I even got it right.
Right. Interesting.
That's so funny. In my experience, there's only one question. Is that bottle more or less than $20? And then I can decide whether or not I'm going to enjoy drinking it.
But that's not the point, Tyler, because there are certain wines that are just more expensive. But if you understand that, you could find good deals. Also, you might not like those expensive wines, right? So, you know, there's certain wines that you stay away from. And then also, you're going to learn that there are excellent wines that are going to cost you $12. Like, you can get a Vinho Verde from Portugal. It's going to cost you $9.99. You walk into a party with a case of those and you're a hero.
You know, it's funny. I thought I kind of teed you up for this, where I thought what you were going to say was the correlation between wine and the markets is that just because it's a good wine, it doesn't mean it's worth the price. Or sometimes you can get a good wine for a cheap price. Whereas in the markets as well, just because it's a good company doesn't make it a good stock, right? And it may be a bad company, it might be an awesome stock, right? And those are the differences that we wrestle with every day.
It all comes down to your own personal objectives in both the market and in wine. Like, you could tell me this is the best day trade in the world, this Micron day trade. I'm not going to put it on because I don't day trade. I'm a terrible day trader. So I'm just not going to do it. And you could be like, but JC, this is the, I'm all in. This is the trade. And you can make $1 zillion and I'll be happy for you and I'll let you buy me drinks. But like, I'm just not going to put it on no matter how much conviction you have. Right. And I can tell you about this Luna YOLO that I got on, and you're going to be like, JC's crazy. I'm not putting it on. This is Luna. Right. So, you know, and then the same thing with wine. Like, if it's noon in Miami on the beach, am I going to drink a Cabernet Sauvignon or a Super Tuscan or like a Syrah? No. I'm going to have a nice, bright Riesling or a Sauvignon Blanc or like, you know, a Chablis, right?
Yeah. All right. So thinking about your clients and the process at All Star Charts, obviously you have your own objectives in how you like to look at the markets and the time horizon that you care about. Do you ever find that certain clients can influence you to look at things a different way or modify what you're publishing to meet their objectives? Does that ever influence your process?
We listen to our customers in terms of what they want. We're generally doing it, right? So we don't really get a, hey, can you guys look at this? Like, we're looking at it. That's never really an issue. But in terms of listening to our clients, like, our clients are really, really, really smart. I don't know if you do this, Dave, when you talk, but I have like certain workbooks that are just ticker symbols that I get asked about by customers of mine. And I just keep those workbooks. And I got to tell you, I go through those workbooks a lot and they are awesome. And there's, you know, trades that you just miss. Like, we do so much work. We have so many scans. We look at so many charts. And even still, there are some things that slip through the cracks. And I yell at the team. I'm like, how did this slip through the cracks? And it's like, well, because our mid-cap scan is minuscule, like little sliver that it slipped through. I was like, okay, we got to fix this. Right. So that's how you keep fine tuning. But, I learned about ETFs that I didn't know existed. We have a lot of financial advisors. You know, I learn about more sophisticated bond trades, about like what the institutional positioning currently is and where the weakness is at the institutional level, like where there's too much exposure. Like, those buttons and catalysts I get from our larger institutional conversations where I get color on those markets.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I'd like to definitely dive into markets specifically, because again, you have a prolific mindset on all the different markets around the world. But before we do that, so that we can help our listeners frame how you're thinking about things, can you maybe just run through the tools that you rely most heavily on, the time frame you focus on, some indicators and, you know, averages and whatever you overlay on the chart?
Yep. So for me, the fewer the lines on the chart, the better. You know, we've all seen those charts. It's got like 200 moving averages, 10 indicators, Bollinger Bands. Like you got, it's like, which one's price? You know, yeah. So for me, I am like less is more through and through. Price is trend. We know that. People are like, oh, it's just random. It's like, well, we know it's not random. Like we have the math. Returns don't fall in a normal distribution. Like markets trend. So because markets trend and we know that, that's why technical analysis works. Because what are we doing? We're looking for trends. And that just happens to be what markets do. So I incorporate a multiple time frame approach, which is something also that is difficult to do with other disciplines, is incorporate the same viewpoints, but on different time horizons to be able to use them together. So we'll start with a longer term view going back 20, 30 years, depending on the asset, maybe even longer than that. You know, we do have like cycle work on interest rates and gold and like things that have traded for 100 years, but on a more, you know, day to day stuff, 20 years, 25 years, just so you can get a few cycles. That's where we start. Whenever in doubt, zoom out. And we do that to get structural perspective on those trends on both an absolute and relative basis. So we're looking at them on their own, and then we're looking at them relative to their alternatives. And when I say, what are we looking at? Every single country's index in the world, developed markets, emerging markets, both in local currency and priced in United States dollars. So we do both. Every U.S. stock market index from S&P, Dow, NASDAQ, small caps, mid caps, micro caps, value line, all of those things. We do the same thing for every commodities future, everything from oil and natural gas to silver and gold and platinum to sugar and soybeans and coffee to cardamom futures in India and palm oil futures in Malaysia and everything in between, really to get perspective and find themes that are going on globally. So same thing with interest rates in all of those countries as well, and all of the currency crosses as well in all of those countries. So by the time we get to tech stocks, or, you know, financials, or even the S&P 500, there's so much other analysis that's already been done that we're going to take this U.S. action and put it into context with everything else. So everything we do falls within the global macro landscape, which is that top-down approach that I was talking about with wine. Like, it's a white wine, it ain't Cabernet. Right.
It felt like a Salvador Dali painting the other day. I looked at, I think it was your Twitter feed, gold priced in yen. I was like, it's not the chart of gold. What are you doing, JC? This is like, but it was totally mind altering. You know, you got to look at things from a different perspective.
Yeah, but I learned that stuff from the technicians, because when I first got into technical analysis, 2005, 06, 07, who are my mentors? Alan Shaw, Luis Yamada, John Roque, all these guys, they were all gold bugs. So I was a gold bug too. And everything, any good technician was a gold bug in the 2000s because the trend was up. Totally. Right? So like, they were right. And anyway, I always laugh about it because people are like, JC, you always give the gold bugs a hard time. It's like, I was a gold bug. Hello. Like, I know what gold bugs are. And, you know, gold just really acts more of like a currency than a commodity. You know, for me, it's kind of like in purgatory, probably has, you know, characteristics of both. So we treat it as such. So not only do we treat it as a commodity, like even the last year, every commodity in the world went up except for gold. So we treat it that way. And, you know, gold price in Japanese yen is making new all-time highs. Gold price in euro making new all-time highs. You know, as we get that breadth expansion, if you will, in terms of gold in different denominations, we have 29 of them that we look at, and we're getting breadth expansion. We're getting new highs in gold price in more and more currencies. You know, just because we've seen dollar strength, if you take the dollar out of the equation, gold has actually done very well, particularly in Japanese yen. Now, the ongoing joke at the firm internally is like, well, JC, if you price anything in Japanese yen, it's going to look good, right? And while that might be true, you know, it's also in some of the other currencies that it's breaking out also. So we have to respect that.
Let's hop into markets. There's obviously a lot going on these days on many fronts. Obviously, inflation hitting, depending on how you measure it, 20-year highs in terms of rate of change, gold not moving, dollar going up, war in Europe, commodities exploding. And you see it better than anybody, all the activity going on beneath the surface of the market, not just here in the U.S., but globally as well. It seems like there's been a lot of false breakouts in many cases, in both directions, you could argue. So when you finish your comprehensive review of the world, where does it leave you today? What asset classes do you want to favor for the next year? And I don't think it's worth talking about the next 3 to 5 years, because that's not how we think. Let's call it the next year.
That's probably bad. I mean, I don't know what I'm having for dinner tonight, yet alone what I'm going to be trading in 5 years, right?
We know you're not eating complex carbs, JC. Looking good, man.
Program. Shout out Phil Perlman. we've been on this commodity super cycle sort of thing. And, you know, we say that like tongue in cheek, like, I don't know if it's a super cycle. Maybe it's a super duper cycle. Like, I have no idea. But what I do know is that it's hard for me to find a better catalyst to spark a new commodity secular bull market than crude oil trading below zero. I mean, can you draw it up any sweeter than that? So as soon as that happened, the unwind began. And that's why after a decade of stocks outperforming commodities, you know, that parabolic, you know, ripper with gold, with oil trading below zero, that was it. That was the bubble popping there. And it's been a commodities outperformance ever since. Commodities are now making 3-year highs relative to the S&P 500. And what do we know about these commodities trends, both on an absolute and relative basis, is that these aren't swing trades. These aren't things that last days or weeks. These trends last a decade. So if we've been at this for a couple of years now, like, maybe we're in the second inning. Maybe we're entering the third, perhaps, you know, and they're like, oh, well, maybe we go into extra innings. Who knows? Right. So
yeah.
You know, but when I see that and then I look at energy as a percentage of the overall S&P 500, it's like 2%, 2.something% of the S&Ps. You got 2% S&Ps are materials. Right. So when you look at the NASDAQ 100 or the NASDAQ in general, there's 0% in energy. There's 0% in materials. So when I look at the composition of most American portfolios, they got a ton of growth. They got a ton of technology and consumer discretionary and communication. They got no commodities, no commodities whatsoever. And I think that that pain is starting to be felt. You've seen growth stocks get slaughtered over the last year, like slaughtered, like almost half the NASDAQ got cut in half. Like, hello, people are like, geez, are we going into a bear market? It's like, what the hell do you call that? Right? Yeah. You know,
already happened.
Yeah, no, that's what I was referring to, like all the stuff going on beneath the surface when it just seems like a nice docile bull market now with like a little 10% correction. There has been epic bear markets going on beneath the surface all the while. So one of the things you just said I thought was interesting was oil going below zero, planting the seeds for the next secular bull run. I can't help but ask the question, you must feel the same way about rates.
Yeah, hard not to, right? You know, and when you look, you asked about inflation, right? So you got commodities doing what they're doing. It's not a secret. They've all been ripping, obviously, from the ags to the energies to the base metals. And then when you look at what the bond market's saying, and you look at inflation protected treasuries versus traditional treasuries making new highs. So you got the bond market pointing to inflation. You got the commodities market pointing to inflation. Stocks are probably doing great in that environment and bonds should be doing terribly. And guess what? Bonds have been doing terribly. And what types of stocks should be doing well in that environment and which stocks should be doing poorly? Well, your growth stocks, technology, those are the ones that historically do poorly in that sort of environment. Meanwhile, your energies, your materials, your industrials, your financials, you got your insurance stocks, they tend to outperform in that sort of environment. And guess what? Those are the stocks that have been outperforming. So when people are talking about how crazy the market is, I couldn't think of anything more normal. The market is doing what it should be doing in this environment. I mean, I couldn't think of anything less crazy.
To your point, which you alluded to earlier, to use your phrase, these kids don't know anything about this because they never managed through it. I mean, this is the first time. Think about this. If rates break through, I don't know what it is. It's probably 265, maybe it's 270, the trend line on the 10-year note off the 1980 peak. If it breaks through that trend line, it'll be the first time since 1980 that we've broken that downtrend. So there's literally at least a generation or more of investors who have never invested during a rising rate environment.
And we've all been there and we all have to learn the hard way and we all got punched in the face and we all thought we knew and we had figured out that we didn't know. Like, we've all gone through that. But at the end of the day, the data is there. So like, even though you haven't traded through it, you could study prior areas. Like, by the way, I was born in 1982. So interest rates have been going down for 40 years. So I need to figure out a way to learn how to trade in a rising rate environment because maybe this isn't it. I don't know. Maybe it's not. Maybe there's one more low. Who knows? But one day it's going to happen and I need to just deal with it. And I've never seen it in my entire life, let alone my career, my life. So people are just going to have to realize that we've been in rising rate environments in the past, you know, more cyclical anyway. And we have been in environments where growth is the afterthought. Growth is the outperformer. Growth is the underperformer. And that tends to happen in rising rate environments. And rates have been going up. and growth has been underperforming. Makes perfect sense.
So it sounds like long commodities, is it fair to say commodities across the board, other than gold, which seems to stubbornly be not, I guess you'd put silver in that camp as well, but is it industrial metals, grains, energy across the board pretty much?
I think what we're seeing is that we're getting this breakout in copper, you know, and if we get the breakout in copper, gold's probably going with it, but I'm more interested in the copper because of the implications there. You know, you look at things like U.S. Steel, Freeport-McMoRan, Nucor, like all of these things continue to act well. You look at steel futures, they continue to press up against new highs. You know, for me, all of those things point to rising rates. So I'm very intermarket oriented. So like, if you're asking me about rates, I'm going to think about what commodities are doing, and I'm going to think about which stocks are doing well. You know, if you ask me about commodities, I'm going to think about what rates are doing. I'm going to think about what stock, right? Like that's how
That's great.
And you talk about a diagonal trend line. Me, I'm more of a horizontal trend line kind of guy.
So for me,
I'm looking at.
Can you explain why? Explain what you mean by that's a super important point. I couldn't agree with you more. Can you explain what you mean by diagonal versus horizontal and why you'd prefer one over the other?
Yeah, you know, there's a tool called Market Profile, which is really, really useful, especially for new traders, people new to technical analysis, because you can actually see the volume on the y-axis by price as opposed to by date, right? So instead of on the x-axis, you have it on the y. After a while, after you do this enough, you don't need that anymore. You know where the volume is because you can just see the churn on the charts and the support and resistance. But that's really where technical analysis begins and ends, as far as I'm concerned. All the other stuff is gravy. You know, we want to draw our trend lines with crayons horizontally at former peaks. When something's going up, stock, ETF, commodity, whatever, going up, if it reverses at a certain price and starts falling, why is that happening? It's happening because there's more supply than demand at that price. There's more selling pressure than buying pressure. There are more willing sellers than buyers there, or maybe one big aggressive seller, whatever. But there's more supply than demand there. So the next time that the stock returns to that level, we need to assume that there's still going to be overhead supply there because the market hasn't proven that demand has finished absorbing that supply. Until the market proves that and we're able to exceed those former highs, then it's guilty until proven innocent, and there's still overhead supply at that price. Many times that second test does fail and we do retreat back. And then maybe the third time, by then maybe demand will have absorbed that overhead supply and we break out, but probably not. And it needs to return again. And that digestion of supply takes time. And you can visualize that in a chart. You could see where that churning is taking place, which creates these really critical levels. Because once we're able to exceed those levels and make new highs, anytime that we return to those levels, we know mathematically there's more demand than supply. The market proved that last time we were here. So we want to be accumulating in those conditions. And if it were to fail, that's information then too. But it all comes down to supply and demand dynamics and the way markets trade, whether we're looking at stocks, ETFs, options, commodities, currencies, cryptocurrencies. It's all a supply and demand game. And you can see that happening in real time in a chart.
Just to restate what you said with a horizontal and then compare that to a diagonal trend line. So our listeners should be thinking about a horizontal line as just being drawn off the top of what's a clear former resistance level or a clear former support level, either way. But it's a horizontal line across the chart. And the reason it's important is because that demarks on the chart a clear point of inflection in supply and demand. Then what we're also prone to do as technicians is to then take all those former highs and draw trend lines off of them, thereby having a diagonal trend line. And wherever that trend line happens to be when we hit it could be completely irrelevant because that specific level may have nothing to do with supply and demand. Is that the distinction you would draw?
Yeah. I mean, they serve a purpose, you know, more of like a rate of change of price, you know, and That's stuff right. like yeah. that. But in yeah. terms of pure supply and demand dynamics, like I was explaining before, like you just said, it's not that, right? It's two different things. So because supply and demand, because support and resistance is the most important thing, then by definition, it's going to be the horizontal is going to be more important than the diagonal.
You know, JC, when we were talking about the curriculum, all the changes that have happened in the CMT Association, since you went through the program, a lot of it has to do with how our association is talking to the rest of the industry, in particular, people who are well-versed in the fundamental aspects of evaluation. And what we're talking about right now with support and resistance levels I think was really well explained or was embraced by the academic community when it came out of the mouths of behavioral psychologists like Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. And when we talk about support and resistance, they talk about the anchoring bias. And I think for everybody who's listening to this podcast, if they're, you know, if you're still on the fence about whether or not you think markets are purely efficient, JC has done a lot of work on the human behavioral element. And it's just, it's faster to explain when looking at a chart, and you can see where people actually put money to work or took money off the table. As they say, people vote with their feet, right? You watch where their money is going rather than what they're talking about. And that's, I mean, to me, support and resistance levels and the anchoring bias, that's the proof in the pudding of why we have to pay attention to technicals, because humans are not purely rational creatures, right? We just want to get out back at that level where we bought it. It's been a negative position for all these weeks or months or days or whatever in your portfolio, and you just want to sell the minute you get back to break even, right? That's the human, right? Human name. Good resources on behavioral finance that you like?
Listen, Tyler, I think you nailed it. It's really what it is. Once you understand the way humans are thinking, understand it a little bit better. You don't have to be an expert. You don't have to be a PhD. Like, you know, a couple of books will do it. You know, anything, yeah. You know, Thinking Fast and Slow and all the stuff by Daniel Kahneman. I mean, fantastic. John Beck does a lot of good work. Annie Duke is fantastic. She's great. Dr. Brett Steenbarger, one of the old school OG. I mean, this is Paul Tudor Jones's personal trading coach, to the point where he was the trading coach for a lot of other traders. And Paul Tudor Jones is like, no, now you work just for me. Like, that's what a badass Dr. Brett Steenbarger. So like, and he talks to the best traders in the world, like constantly. Andrew Menneker out in San Francisco, mm-hmm. good egg. Dr. Phil Perlman, obviously, you know, yeah. Mental and physical side of performance and being and putting yourself in the position to make smart decisions.
Sounds like commodities bullish, which naturally and obviously, but we can also see the charts translates to bearish bonds. Equities sounds, because there's a lot in the equity world, not just in terms of sectors, but in terms of cap sizes, regions, and everything else.
Yeah.
I mean, if you got to think about the next year, I know you've been pretty bullish on emerging markets. That's been a trade that's been slowly working its way up into actually becoming pretty decent leadership on the long-term charts. Is that where you'd be focusing your exposure on the equity side?
Yeah. So the way I like to think about it, you know, this isn't your father's emerging markets, right? This isn't like, you know, the way I grew up, emerging markets had much more like natural resource exposure. You know, when you look at something like EEM, a lot more energy and materials and less technology. And now it's like 40% China, ton of technology. So yeah. I think it's important to remember that, again, this isn't your father's EEM. This is a different emerging market. So I think you need to be more careful with different regions. Like when you talk about like China, for example, has had a terrible start to the year, but you look at Brazil and Peru and Chile, I mean, these things have been ripping. And why? Their natural resource exposure as opposed to all that tech in China. And China's got some other things going on, whatever. You know, you look at the strength in Canada, for example, you know, what are the types of stocks that do well in a rising rate environment? You're going to get some of the more cyclical value oriented sectors. And what's Canada? A lot of natural resources and banks. Like, hello, like if this is, mm-hmm. if Canada can't do well in this market, like it's never going to do well. So you're seeing some outperformance out of Canada for similar reasons that you're seeing outperformance out of Latin America. When was the last time you could say outperformance in Latin America in the same sentence, David?
Yeah, it's since the last full cycle in commodities, right?
Early 2016 or something like that, that lasted a hot second. Like,
Yeah.
Yeah. You're going to give any love to the Australians and the Kiwis?
You know, Australia should do well. I mean, I got to tell you, from a currency perspective, that Australian dollar versus Japanese yen ripping, man, mm-hmm. from a risk appetite perspective, when you see that Aussie yen doing what it's doing. By the way, if you overlay a chart of Bitcoin with a chart of Aussie yen, woo, they look exactly the same. So I give love to the Aussies. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to Bitcoin for sure. Okay. So for a domestic U.S. investor, the way you translate your exposure and towards these themes is obviously energy materials, deep cyclical. So it sounds like, would you say value over growth? That sounds pretty obvious.
I mean, you're getting mean reversions in the really beat up growth names. And I think those mean reversions probably still have some legs. And, you know, again, I'm not saying technology stocks can't go up or growth can't go up. Well, where do you want to be? Do you want to be in the leadership or do you want to be bottom fishing the garbage? And if you are bottom fishing the garbage and there's nothing wrong with that, and we have done that, I think it's important to understand that that is a trade, right? That is a mean reversion trade. Those are not secular leaders. So if you're buying Freeport or you're buying, you know, U.S. Steel, or you're buying, you know, uranium, CCJ breaking out of this base, if you're buying those things, that's one trade. If you're buying DraftKings and you're buying like any of these disasters and all these Cathie Wood funds, like if you're buying those, it's a mean reversion. And that, you, as long as you know that and you understand that, I think you're okay. But they're two different things. And I think there's a time and a place for both of those things. Again, it all comes down to your objectives. Are you trying to drink Cabernet Sauvignon at noon on the beach? Probably not, right? Like, are you trying to, you know, buy leadership? You know, and again, these relative trends can last a long time. And I think the fact that U.S. investors have no exposure to these areas, energy, materials, none whatsoever, I think is really a bullish catalyst. Not to mention, sentiment in general has been so pessimistic, by our work. We were this quarter at some of the most pessimistic levels since we've seen since 2016, which is worse, more bearish than during the pandemic when we were staring into the abyss. So the fact that there's more pessimism today, I think that's a bullish catalyst. You know, I don't think it's going to be a straight up line, but we want to be buying weakness in energy. We want to be buying weakness in materials. I think industrials, I think the countries with exposure there continue to outperform. I think this is a secular theme until the market proves otherwise. And I think interest rates go with it. You know, so you fade bond strength, you continue to fade bond strength. You know, you're going to get mean reversions there too, for sure. But I think 3% on US 10-year yields, a lock, you know, oil, 200, 250, why not? You know, I don't think it gets there tomorrow. I don't know if it ever gets there, but I think as investors, not as technicians or CMTs or portfolio managers, forget all that. Just as humans, as investors, when we approach the market and be like, okay, what am I going to do with my portfolio? I think oil at 250, you know, gold at 5,000, 10,000. I don't know that they ever get there, but I think we need to think and approach the market thinking that that's on the table. And what does that world look like? And are investors ready for that? And I would argue, absolutely not.
No. Mm-hmm. So be open-minded, right?
I think you have to be.
You know, for anybody that's struggling with believing just because of behavioral bias and anchoring bias and whatnot, any of our listeners that are struggling with believing that tech could possibly underperform for an extended period, even if they do well in the short term, doesn't have to look any further than after the 2000 peak and all those stocks tanked 90%. 50 to 90%, lots of them went out of business. And then that sector went sideways for a very long time, underperforming for a very long time. And so wash, rinse, repeat. There's nothing different today about what happened back then. And so there's no reason why we couldn't see that type of a scenario. They don't have to keep going down, but if we're trying to buy leadership, that's an important context to keep in mind, right?
I think so. And the fact that they're not able to knock them down, you look at small cap growth doing really well this week. You know, you're getting these mean reversions in these growth tech, archy, you know, is the adjective we use, archy type stocks. If they can't knock those down, who's left to bring the market down, right?
Yeah. And of course, AMC just bought a gold company and quickly broke out of a base, right? Go figure.
David, nothing surprises me anymore.
Yeah, you've seen enough, right? You think you've seen it all, right? And then AMC buys a gold company. Okay,
yeah,
so.
Of course. Yeah, for sure. Right. Movie theater buying gold companies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can see the synergies.
Have that one?
Yeah. I saw that coming from a mile away. Okay, so there's only two remaining asset classes. So let's go with the old school snooze city, the dollar, and then we'll get to the more exciting crypto. What's going on there? It's going up. What's going on?
Why are you hating on the dollar, David?
I'm not. I love it. I think is kind of comical is if you look at the chart, it's actually in a range. And so there's been a lot of noise about what the dollar is and isn't doing, but the actual reality, the truth of the matter is it's doing nothing. Now I'm talking about the Dixie, right? Yeah. Which is really driven by the euro. There's a lot of other things going on. There's a lot of currencies, as we've already talked about, a lot of crosses that are moving quite a bit. But the dollar index, the Dixie, is basically range bound. And it kind of looks bullish.
Are you talking about the range going back to 2014, Dave? Or are you talking about the range more recently?
Make me look at my charts, are you?
Yeah.
Listen, I could draw it for you. I'm going to tell you about the dollar. This is what I think investors need to know about the dollar.
Yeah.
First of all, technicians love overthinking the dollar. So I think as investors, I think it's very important to know where your weaknesses are. One of my personal weaknesses, I've historically overthink the intermarket relationship. So I always have to be cautious of that and always ask myself, am I overthinking the intermarket? Right. Also, just in general, the overthinking of the dollar for sure. I see it so much. I do it myself. We all do it. So I'm not saying don't think about the dollar, but I think it's important to, if you're overthinking, if you catch yourself overthinking the dollar, which I do a lot, ask yourself, are you overthinking the dollar? Okay. So with that caveat, the US dollar index has had a very strong negative correlation with risk assets for about the last half decade. Really got going strong in 2016 when stocks broke out in Q4 around the election in 2016. Actually broke out in September, but whatever. They started getting going. And what happened? The dollar fell apart. So stocks peak in January 2018. What happens? Dollar bottoms that quarter, starts ripping. After the COVID, dollar peaked, dollar gets slaughtered, stocks rip, best year in history or something for, you know, stocks, depending on what index you're looking at. And then what happened a year ago? Growth stocks start getting hit, advanced decline line peaks in February, you know, of 2021. A lot of things, that was the best things were. Everybody had a SPAC, if you recall, you know, all crazy things are happening. That's when the dollar was bottoming. So since then, we've seen dollar strength and we've seen deterioration and a lot of stocks being sold over the last year. So if you can get this dollar weakness, and I think that it's setting up, if you look at the dollar index in particular, if you're looking at about 97, 98, if we lose that and we're right there, that is the 61.8% retracement of the entire 2020 decline in the dollar. That's 61.8%. So we start losing 97 and we start breaking below that. I think that's a heck of a catalyst for risk assets. And I'll tell you one more thing. With new highs in the US dollar index over the last month, we have an advanced decline line of 29 currencies against the United States dollar, right? So we're essentially looking at all of the other crosses, not something that's 60% euro and another 10, 12% yen that's gotten murdered, right? So if you sort of take those out of the equation, you equally weigh 29 currencies all over the world. With new highs in the dollar index, you had lower highs in Q1, throughout Q1 in that AD line. So essentially, breadth deterioration at the currency level of dollar denominated currencies around the globe, setting the stage and a bearish momentum divergence if you're looking at a 14-day RSI, if you're into that sort of thing. So check, 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 check. If we lose 97, dollar gets slaughtered. I mean, I think that's good for commodities. I think it's good for stocks. I think it's good for risk assets. I think it's good for everybody except dollar longs.
As all of that was unfolding, what we can see happening on the charts was that the definition of risk assets, particularly within equities, not equities at the top level, but within equities, the definition of risk assets has actually changed, right? Because prior to, say, 2021, I guess you could even say risk assets were really growth. Mm-hmm. And now risk assets are value. Yeah. So, and that makes sense because if the dollar does break down, that works with commodities breaking out, that works with inflation, that works with value working and all these other things. So when we think about risk assets, we have to also consider the possibility, at least what the charts are saying, is that how we define risk assets today to implement that strategy actually has changed. We need to think about owning energy materials instead of consumer and tech, right?
Tech, yeah.
I think that's right.
All right. So alternative scenario, the dollar doesn't get slaughtered here. What's the reverse play, JC? Let's say we break out of this range and we're back up towards the 2001 highs.
I think the Russell 2000 remains in this messy range. You know, I think just messy markets, sloppy markets that we've been in for the better part of, you know, the last 3-4 months in particular, even some of the stronger areas have really been range bound. Mm-hmm. I think that probably persists dollar strength. I think you'll probably see more weakness out of like Europe and some of these other areas that have gotten hit recently on that dollar strength. You know, listen, it's a possibility. I think it's the lower probability outcome. If you ask me, based on the weight of the evidence, I do think we see dollar weakness. And I think that is confirmed true if we're losing 97 on the dollar index to the downside, and we could really press those bets in that environment. So for right now, it's just, I think this happens, but I have no idea. Mm-hmm. On the breakdown there, I think that's pretty good confirmation, I think.
Excellent. Thank you.
Okay, so that leaves us with the last but newest asset class, crypto, and everything that spins off of that. It's hard for me to ask you what your opinion is of the crypto space, because as technicians, we're not really supposed to have that type of an opinion, because in certain moments, you have to abandon that opinion and just kind of go with the trend. But I do know that you are intricately involved in that industry. You've done a lot of research. You've spoken to a lot of people. So I'm going to ask you anyway. In the 90s, we had the internet, and it changed the world, right? But you couldn't buy the internet. all you could do is buy things that were tangential to the internet, in particular traded on markets, right? So what ended up happening was indeed that the internet did transform the world, but most of those stocks that we played back then went to zero. And if they didn't go to zero, they took a decade to come back, right? Yep. Is it conceivable that today the technology that's transforming the world is blockchain? And this, you can't buy and sell blockchain, right? It's transforming the world, but you can't buy and sell it. So you buy and sell the things that are tangential to it. And if you look at, like, in the beginning of COVID, I mean, I don't know how many thousands of cryptocurrencies came out. It was sort of like an IPO boom in the 90s, right? Is it conceivable that these Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies are mostly going to go away, and there's going to be a Cisco and an Amazon that survived the dot-com bust? There'll be like Bitcoin and Ethereum, but most of these things are going away. That would be my question for you.
Like stocks, right? You know, a lot of stocks go to zero. You never hear about them, penny stocks and things like that. You're going to have that here. I mean, you have them all the time, you know, so they do go to zero. They do disappear, and that's never going to go away. That's a good thing, right? You know, bad companies, you know, poorly designed cryptocurrencies should go to zero. They should fail. Like if you're a terrible business owner, like your company should go under, right? Like if you are a good business owner and you do good things, you know, you have a higher likelihood of it working out for you, right? That's just business. That's just America. That's just global business, not even just America. So I think that's no different. As far as the Bitcoin and Ethereum, you know, you have your layer one applications, and then you have your layer two protocols that do have their own tokens. So it's like, you know, you've got tokens on top of tokens, you know, and that'll continue to evolve because it's like Legos, right? So think about like some of the ones you mentioned, those are like the bottom of the Legos, and you're able to build on top of that because it's all open source. And, you know, I like to stay in my own lane, David. You know, I'm a technical analyst. I look at price. You know, I'm the dumbest guy in the room. You know, I don't need to know anything about oil and gas stocks to trade oil and gas stocks all day. I don't have to do, you know, I don't know anything about semiconductors. I could barely spell semiconductors, but I can name you friggin' 20 of them that I've traded in the last like several months, right? In the case of crypto, and I've always like been very disciplined. In the case of cryptocurrencies, it's been a different experience for me, because I'll have a irresponsibly large position in a particular coin, and I'm just like, hey, you know, maybe I should find out a little bit about this, you know, this Axie Infinity that I own $500,000, stay up all night watching like conspiracy videos on YouTube, you know, to learn about these things. So I've been doing that for the last couple of years, and you pick up a thing or two, you know, through these videos. Now, just to be clear, none of those things have any impact on my decision-making in terms of, you know, trading and investing and risk management, and none of that matters. But just from a personal interest, you know, I've gone out of my way. I made some money trading helium, HNT. So I used some of that and I bought some helium miners, and then I bought some more. And now I have 25 helium miners, you know, all over the East Coast, you know, mining helium for me. I'm making a couple of bucks there, you know, it ain't bad. And then I made some money trading MANA, which is the currency inside of Decentraland, MANA. So what did I do with those profits? I took some of them and I bought some property inside of Decentraland. And it's not like, because I think HNT is going to the moon and, you know, Tom Brady and, you know, the metaverse. Like, I don't know, bro. But going through this process, I've learned a lot just by doing Uniswap, buying NFTs, trading NFTs, like understanding the different communities on Discord. Like, I've come a long way in understanding what's going on behind the scenes like I never have in my life. Because I've never dug into oil and gas, because I really don't care. You know, I've never dug into semiconductors or healthcare. Like, I just don't know anything about that stuff. I'm okay not knowing. I'm good. Like, I like wine and sports and family. Like, that's for me. And now I've learned about the metaverse, and I've learned a lot about blockchain, and it's fascinating. And I know a lot of smart friends that are heavily, heavily involved. I don't think it's going away. There has been more money from venture capitalists invested in the last year than every other year in history combined into Web 3.0. And there's a lot of smart people building really, really cool protocols. And it's just not going away. And it's going to work its way into our everyday lives more and more every day without even people realizing it. And I think it's a good thing.
So along those lines, what is the justification for buying property in Decentraland? Is it just to see what happens, or can you actually state, I bought this parcel because of this? Because there's no chart.
Right. So one thing I learned from venture capital friends of mine, you know, I've been a closet fintech nerd for a long time. Tyler knows, you know, I don't really know how to code. And they say words that I like, words like API, like, I don't know what that is, but I hear it a lot. Like, so I'm not like good with that stuff, but like, I like learning more about it. And one thing I've learned from VC friends of mine, very successful people, is that you got to play with the toys. You got to play with the new toys that the kids are playing with. Like, you know, like Mark Zuckerberg, for example, he was married or he had a girlfriend at the time, but he was playing with Tinder, like, so that he can understand the way that it works. And he actually matched with like one of his wife's friends or something like that. Anyway, the point is, like, you want to play with the toys, even though it's not really up your alley. So like, I have like one of those Oculus headsets, you know, virtual reality. I haven't played a video game since college, but like, I'm learning, right? And same thing with Decentraland. It's not like I'm some real estate mogul in the metaverse, you know, like I don't know. I picked the cheapest one and just got some land and stuff, you know, just go through the process, right?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Interesting. How about Bitcoin here? I mean, we know the chart. It looks pretty similar to the last pullback that it had. Are you a buyer here? With stops, of course.
I like the higher beta cryptocurrencies. So like, if you're bullish Bitcoin, there's probably better vehicles in order to express the bullish thesis.
Same as the market, right?
Yeah. You know, Bitcoin serves this purpose. But what I'm looking at, I'm looking at breadth expansion in the cryptos. So what you're seeing is the new 52-week high list was non-existent all year. And now you're getting Waves, you're getting Luna, you're getting the ApeCoin breaking out to new 52-week highs, new all-time highs in those cases. And we haven't seen that in a while. And you're also seeing breadth thrusts. You know, David, I know you've done a lot of work in the past looking at different breadth thrusts. A lot of technicians do, obviously, because it's very powerful information. We just got a whole slew of breadth thrusts in the stock market, for example.
Yeah.
And now you're seeing like expansion in percentage of cryptos above their 10-day moving average, percentage of cryptos above their 30-day moving average, off the charts. Right. So and then expansion in the new all time highs list, you know, a lack of new lows, expansion in new highs, like, does this stuff sound familiar, right?
Yeah. So what's interesting about that is that you're just taking very creatively and very uniquely, because I don't know anybody else that's doing that, but you're just taking the old school lessons that you've learned from how to actually make money in equities, and you're taking those same technical tools and translating them to Bitcoin because it's a price.
That's all it is. So
like anything else.
What are we looking at? We're looking at support and resistance. We're looking at breadth. Mm-hmm. We're looking at relative strength, right? So Bitcoin's nowhere near the new highs, but Waves and Luna and ApeCoin are breaking out to new highs. So the relative strength is there. You have different sectors. So you've got like your DeFi protocols, you've got your exchanges. So you've got like different sectors within crypto in the same way that you've got financials and healthcare and utilities in the stock market, right? It's no different. You have your different groups. And then, you know, when relative strength is popping up, like, it comes out on the scans just like they would in growth stock scan, right? It's no different. And then the one thing that I would say that really adds a new layer of analysis that I've never done before and nobody ever has either is all of the on-chain analytics. We don't have the transparency that we have in crypto and some of those other asset classes. I wish we did. Like, in the bond market, you got to trust that they're not lying to you and that the auditor's not full of it. And what do we know about both of those things? Like, very, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. So you have to trust that their balance sheet is what they say it is. And we're old enough to know that a lot of times it ain't, right?
Yeah.
In crypto, you know, when you are staking in a stability pool, you know to the penny how much, what percentage of the pool you represent. In other words, what does the balance sheet look like? You see it in real time, not to mention you see all of the transactions. So we track the transactions in different wallets. So you can see what the whales are doing that own more than 10,000, you know, 1,000 to 10,000 Bitcoin in their wallets. You can see what they're doing versus the shrimp that have less than one Bitcoin. And then you have the crabs and the octopus and the dolphin, right? There's different levels in terms of the size. So what does that remind you of? It reminds me of commercial hedgers versus speculators. It reminds me of the odd lot trades from back in the 70s. You know, it's very similar themes, and it all comes down to human behavior. We're just calling it different things, but it's the same thing. You know, it's like, you know, stability pool. Oh, like a market maker. Yeah, I know what those are, right? You know,
yeah,
they used awesome. To exist on the floor.
Thanks for that time. That was great, JC. Thank you for that explanation. That was really fantastic.
I wanted to ask, in your opinion, is there a major difference trading within the cryptocurrency space because of the volatility? Do you think about charts with maybe looking at them on a little longer time horizon? Do you think about using a thicker crayon for your trend lines so that you're not stopped out so quickly? I mean, any words of wisdom in terms of the difference in volatility of this asset class versus others?
Yeah. So I think that you need to adjust for time. So the stock market trades on average 31 and a half hours per day, right? On a week, 31 and a half hours per week, right? Yeah. It's about 32 and something. But when you smooth it out with all the holidays and stuff, it works out to 31 and a half hours per week in the stock market. In crypto, it trades 168 hours per week. So you really have to adjust for time. So what we do is for our, what would be the equivalent to weekly charts in the stock market is really the daily charts in crypto. And what would be the daily charts in the stock market is really the 4-hour charts in crypto. So we're looking at 4-hour charts in crypto to get the equivalent data of the daily charts in the stock market. So I think that time adjusted analysis, I think, is important. And then one other thing that I'd add, you guys have known me for a long time, know I'm always talking about monthly candles. It's like my favorite thing to do is look at monthly charts, monthly candles, and then with the ratios, I use monthly lines, right? Boy, does it bring you back home. You know, like those who are into yoga, like, you know how, like, when you start thinking about stuff, like, you have to, like, focus on your breathing, like, bring you back home. Those are the monthly charts. Brings you back to the primary trends. And it's like, oh, yeah, that's been going up for a while. Yeah, that's right. Because it's so easy to get caught up in the noise. I got to tell you, weekly charts in crypto, you want to keep your sanity? Look at weekly charts in crypto is a good way to really zoom out. In the same way that monthly charts are great for stocks and, you know, all the other asset classes.
And just to be clear, when you say weekly charts in crypto, you literally mean weekly chart, or do you mean the daily, as you described it earlier?
Literally weekly, right? Yeah, to really take a step. I mean, granted, some of these cryptocurrencies, you're going to get like 2 bars, but like, you know. So there's new issues, by the way. In the same way that in the stock market, you have new IPOs, you've got SPACs, right? So we try to keep tabs on all the new issues and stuff like that. It's no different in crypto.
And do you know of a crypto index that's, you know, well known and followed out there, or do you guys have one yourselves? Or
So we have like a top 5 and a top 10, you know, index, like by market cap, that we equally weight. So we do that stuff, and it really does help. We do a lot of relative strength analysis. I would say, if anything, David, that I have translated from traditional assets into new digital assets, that has been the most helpful of anything that I've moved over. Relative strength. Crypto is real. When you're seeing all these cryptos selling off and there's a few of them that are green, there's something funky going on there. And when all the cryptos are up and there's a few that are down, like, you stay away from those. You know what I mean? Like, I'm super telling you, relative strength, guys. I'm telling you. Yeah.
When you said relative strength, most of us, or some of us, might think the relative performance line between, you know, Google and the S&P. So it's Google compared to the S&P. Do you do that type of work? And I'm curious, if you do that, do you just compare crypto to crypto, or do you actually have an index that you would compare a crypto to that crypto index?
Yep. So we do all of the above. So we'll compare the different cryptocurrencies to Bitcoin. We'll use Bitcoin as the denominator, like we would the S&P 500, for example.
Yeah.
We create equally weighted indexes that will compare the crypto to those equally weighted indexes. And we'll take it a step further, and we create, and they already have a few that exist, but we create our own indexes that it's like an equally weighted DeFi protocol index, an equally weighted exchange index. And then we can compare, you know, the exchange to the basket of exchanges, if you will, in the same way that you would do like Bank of America versus financials ratio, right?
Right. Got it. Good stuff. Tyler, anything on your end? This has been fantastic.
You promised us before we hit the record button that your secret to success is being the dumbest guy in a room. So I think you just top-ticked it, Juan Carlos. You just schooled Dave and I. That was fantastic.
You guys know everything I'm talking about. Like, I'm not reinventing the wheel here.
No, you're exactly right. History doesn't always repeat, but it rhymes, and nothing different about this asset class than any of the others. JC, I want to close a little bit just in thinking about you as a business owner and manager, in the sense that a lot of our listeners are really focused on their own portfolio and their process, and they're sort of, you know, sole contributors or independent athletes, but you've built All Star Charts to have a whole team. And now, you know, you're running a company and you're managing other people and you've got all these client relationships. How much does that take you away from the charting and the markets themselves? You said you hate accounting, but I got to imagine you have to pay attention to some of those things when you run a business.
I hate it so much, Tyler. I hate it so much. There is there are few things in this world that I have as much of a passionate hatred for accounting. I hate it so much. Fortunately for me, I have Danny Jassy. Shout out Spider Crusher. Danny is like, he loves spreadsheets. I hate them. Match made in heaven. And the more business I do, the more spreadsheets he gets. So great. And then I would also say having a good team around you is really, really important. You know, I'm getting, you know, reports every single day on different asset classes, workbooks with hundreds, if not thousands of charts, whether it's breadth or commodities or currencies. And I could flip right through those and I can make changes. Hey, change that. Add this chart. Take that one out. Hey, do a ratio of this versus that. And they're on it. You know, I could spend all day building some breadth algorithm, or I could be like, yo, Grant, I need this. And then with this percentage of this moving average, you know, and there's no, and for those of us who have been through multiple cycles, there's no like magic breadth indicator or magic like thrust indicator. Like you have to think about what market environment we're in and what information you want to visualize to then tell Grant, be like, Grant, I want it like this because of this, which is way different than how it was 2 years ago. Or whatever, you know, for example, like the 2018 highs was a key pivot high in a lot of countries and a lot of stocks. So over the years, we've done scans that pivot to those highs. So prior to that, we never did that because those highs didn't exist yet. So that's just a good example of anchoring to certain dates or anchoring to certain price points or whatever. That's the secret. The secret is have a good team that you trust around you. Shout out Steve Straza, Ian Cully, you know, Willie Delwich, Sean McLaughlin, Rashmi Shastri, I mean, Louis Sykes. You know, we got a crew. We got a crew. Giancarlo and the whole team. I mean, it's a beautiful thing. Alfonso's coming to D.C. next month. You'll meet
Alfonso. We're going to meet Alf Charts in person. I can't wait. JC, this has been such a fantastic interview. I really appreciate, you know, all of the work that you have done on behalf of the whole technical community, not just for All Star Charts and the crew that you've built, but for all of us in terms of making sure that the rest of the industry understands what professional technical analysts do. I'm looking forward to our next conversation. Next one's going to be not in this virtual environment, but face-to-face at the symposium, cold drinks in hand. Maybe a Chablis, you know.
Well, that you pick.
Are we getting fancy? We drink a Chablis?
Depends on what case you're going to bring. I'm rocking up with those $9 Vino Verdes, is what I heard earlier in this conversation.
Bro, you know, that Burgundy, that'll get you.
That'll get you. I want you to take care of the family, the wife, new baby. Enjoy and congratulations on all of the success, JC. It's been fantastic.
David, thank you very much, man. This is quite an honor.
Absolutely, man. We'll see you in Washington.
All right, adios.
Fill the Gap is brought to you with support from Optima. In addition to candidate study of the official CMT curriculum, Optima provides a full video course on all of the material that candidates need to know for each level of the CMT exams. Each course is broken up into modules ranging from 15 to 45 minutes, depending on the complexity and length of the topics being covered. Learn more at optima.com.